everybody, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, a show serving the greater bleeding disorder community, brought to you by Believe Limited and Bloodstream Media, and made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. Y'all, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but it's just me today. You are stuck with me. There's no Patrick. It is just me. I am your healthcare advocate, nonprofit nerd, and your host, Amy Board. And seriously, it's just me today. But as always, I'm reminding you to please speak with a healthcare professional before making any treatment decisions. On today's show, again, it's just me, but it's going to be a banger of a show. We have newly appointed NBDF CEO Phil Cotone with us. He's going to share his background. He's going to share his vision for the organization and the community. It is his first Bloodstream interview, so we're so excited to welcome Phil on the show. And we actually have the story from the very first commercially dosed hemophilia B gene therapy patient. We get to hear from Jameson Buxton, who actually is the father of the patient, and wait for it, twist, he's also the director of the HTC. It's going to be a fantastic story. We're going to hear from Mason, the patient, as well as some of the HTC staff in future episodes. So it's going to be a fantastic, fantastic segment. You don't want to miss it. We've got all that and more on this episode of Bloodstream. Listeners, as always, thank you for joining me today. And if you like what you hear, please share this episode on all the social media. Please, because it's just me, and I would love for you to share all of this on social media because it's just me and I'm all by my lonesome. I also want to remind you, dear listeners, that the Bloodstream Podcast is made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. That is right, Takeda. Takeda's got this website, bleedingdisorders.com, where you can learn all about Takeda's resources for and commitment to the bleeding disorder community. Takeda believes in a world free of bleeds and are dedicated more than ever in their efforts to offer a wide range of program and support to help patients throughout their treatment journey, wherever on that journey they may be. You can learn more by visiting bleedingdisorders.com. Again, that is bleedingdisorders.com. And for their founding and ongoing support of the Bloodstream Podcast, I would just like to say thank you, Takeda. And of course, thank you to segment sponsor CSL Behring for supporting the gene therapy segment coming up in a few. So y'all, hi, again, it's just me. Apologies that Patrick can't make it. You know, I think one of the things that I love about the Bloodstream Podcast is that we can improvise and do things on the fly. Patrick is going to potentially not be with us for a couple of weeks, a couple of episodes, actually. He is dealing with a lot of very exciting things coming down the pipe in terms of I don't know, some like really cool creative projects. And so we wish him all the best. If you see him on social media, please feel free to be like, Amy's lonely. Please go back to the Bloodstream Podcast. No, he's doing great, but we should be excited and we should encourage him in all the things. Also, this episode is being recorded actually on Monday of HFA Symposium Week. When it is released, it will be Friday, April 12th. So we'll be in full tilt HFA Symposium. Patrick and myself will actually be there. So if you are there, if you're listening to this during symposium, make sure to come and say hi to us, please. And we're just kind of excited to hear how symposium goes. We will be there as a Believe team to premiere our film On the Shoulders with Giants. If you're listening to this right now, it happened last night, Thursday, so hopefully it's great. We can't wait to share all the reactions to the film and all the things, but it's going to be great. So anyway, if you are at HFA, please come find us. You know what I'm saying? But let's get to it. Let's get to the interview that we're all so excited about. Phil Cotone is with us. He is the newly appointed CEO at the National Bleeding Disorders Foundation. A lot of scuttlebutt and hubbub about Phil. I was the one that got to interview him. And I was so psyched because he's a nonprofit nerd. He's a nonprofit nerd, an actual nonprofit nerd. He has a fantastic background in like chronic disease nonprofit work. He is old school. He has like run a local chapter. For those of you that are involved in your local chapters or you run a local chapter, you know that that is a job of love, not a job of financial resources. So hats off to him. But I loved my interview with him. I hope you guys do too. So here it is. Let's go on over to Phil Cotone. Listeners, I am here with the brand new CEO of NBDF, the National Bleeding Disorders Foundation. Phil Gattone is with us. Phil, I told you this before we started recording, but I'm very nerdily excited to talk to you today.
I'm very excited to talk with you too, Amy. It's nice to be here.
And Phil, I guess one of the reasons that I was so excited to talk to you is, and of course, this is the first time that we're meeting, but reading your bio, you are, if you don't mind me saying, a true nonprofit nerd. You have really, I think, given your career, your dedication, your passion to the nonprofit sector and chronic disease. And I just, as a fellow nonprofit nerd, I think that's great. And so I just kind of wanted to hear a little bit about your background, why you love it so much, and kind of what's your philosophy on leading in the nonprofit sector.
Sure. It's so nice to be with you. And I can tell you, I have read about you as well. And so I was equally excited to meet you and thrilled to be speaking with you. You know, my background, over 20 years in nonprofit, really was an almost accidental start. My wife and I both had bachelor's degrees in marketing, public relations, advertising, and we were doing our work. And our son, we have four children, and our oldest son has epilepsy. And when he started having seizures at the age of four, it really changed our lives. And we went to volunteer for a nonprofit organization and a cause that related to our family. And I really didn't realize how that was going to shift my career, because volunteer work, which is really the heart and soul of nonprofit voluntary health, is really special to me. And the community is very special to me. And so that's how we kind of came into the whole idea of getting involved. And that led to an opportunity to work at a medical center in Chicago. I went on and got my master's degree in education. My wife went on and got her degree in education as well. And I ended up serving as director of education at a medical center in Chicago, Rush University Medical Center, in their Department of Neurology. As a layperson, I was going out and doing education in the community and helping families who were visiting. And then I served on the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities for 7 years because our son was really impacted by epilepsy, and his course was a tough one. And so as that happened, the voluntary health organization, the Epilepsy Foundation in Chicago, was the executive director retired, and I threw my hat in the ring, was fortunate to get that post and served there for about 7 years. And all of a sudden, things started to happen, and the National Board of Directors asked if I would consider serving, and I accepted the CEO position in 2012 to serve as CEO of the Epilepsy Foundation. And coming from a chapter background and having the community really at the heart of my experience, I really made an effort to bring that forward in my role as national CEO. And the reason is that, you know, when you think about NBDF and the work that's gone on in the bleeding disorders community, the chapters are really the heart of the organization. And NBDF is the community. It is its community. So it's not this institution. And I think, you know, COVID has borne that out, where we've all become virtual in our work and we're all community based. But it's an important realization to understand that, you know, a national organization, instead of saying we're a national organization, I like to say that we are a nationwide community-based organization. Because when you think about it, parents, spouses, individuals with bleeding disorders, children, teachers, doctors, social workers, nurses, advocates, they are NBDF. And so when I think about our organization, what a privilege to be called by NBDF Board of Directors and asked to speak with them. When I spoke with them, I knew right away that I believe in this community and I believe in this cause. And I thought, wouldn't it be incredible to be able to use the tools that I've developed over the past couple of decades in nonprofit, in fundraising and supportive care initiatives and advocacy, to use those tools to help solve a challenge and serve with a team of people who are really expert in what they do. So that's really how I kind of went through this process and came in. And through the course of my time, 20 years, I've met so many families who have dealt with chronic illness, and maybe their lived experiences weren't bleeding disorders in the past, but they were people who had experienced the pain and the suffering of an unsolved chronic condition and the consequences of that condition. And so when I started here, I went to Washington Days and was able to meet families who were impacted. And oh my gosh, the love and the camaraderie in this community is amazing. And it just took me, it really took me. And I'm so thankful that I have a chance to serve alongside this fraternity. It's a small fraternity because, you know, it's a kind of a combination of several rare diseases and some not so rare, but I feel like we are in a fraternity together, and I feel so fortunate to be able to serve alongside.
That's great. You mentioned challenges, you know, coming in and, you know, kind of really addressing some challenges in your here, this beginning view of your work here, your post here with the bleeding disorders community. What are those challenges? What have you identified?
Well, I think
has the board put in, sure, on your plate, basically?
Yeah. Sure, sure. Yeah, the board, they understand the value of growing our resource base so we can make a bigger impact together. Mm-hmm. And I think they're looking to see if we can't find some diversified revenue streams to help grow our resource base and not be so dependent on one area of revenue streams or two areas, yeah. Where we can really grow our diversification in growing our resources. But secondly, I think there is a need to become united in our community. This is a very broad community, and these are passionate leaders. And I think the events of the past, going all the way back to the times in the 80s, where there were some very, very challenging times for our community. People lost loved ones, and there was some real concern over both the advocacy side and the science side, and those needs still exist for some of our community members today to really understand that there were mistakes made, and that we need to take responsibility for our part in that and acknowledge it, and then move forward with the idea that we're here now, we are working together now, and we have a future that can go one of two ways. We can work together or we can work separately. And so the need, I think, is really to find ways to be strategic in honoring the autonomy of the different organizations that are out there. But at the same time, finding some linkages and some common denominators that we can get behind together and really rally as a community and move the needle, when, not just as it relates to advocacy, which I think we do very well together. Yeah. I think HFA, MBDF, the Alliance, I just feel like we are working together well in certain areas, but we can do more. I think part of my goal is to be able to bring our community together in ways that respects autonomy and honors the work that's been done to this point, and utilize the strengths that we all have. You know, my father was a great pianist, and he was also a conductor of some orchestras and some bands over the years. And when I think about MBDF and I think about our community as a whole, I think of our community really in the same analogy as an orchestra. I think about everybody has some talent that they can offer. And if I'm a conductor in the orchestra as CEO, I am certainly not the best violinist. I am not the best percussionist. I'm not that good at woodwinds, but I know people who are, and they're experts. And I feel like if I can take that talent that's out there and the people who care so deeply. I don't know if you've ever heard the sound of an orchestra before it plays, before the conductor starts, they're warming up. It's kind of a chaotic sound. Everybody's tuning their instruments, they're practicing pieces within the symphony. But then when the conductor comes and brings everybody together and they're all playing from the same page, they can really make a beautiful sound. And I do believe that our community is very much like that, where when we work together, it's really something to see. It's very powerful, and we can make an impact. So my hope is that we can take the strengths that exist out there. And I'm talking about not just organizationally, not just the professional advocates who really know their stuff, but also families and individuals who care deeply about this mission, who have been really personally impacted by a bleeding disorder. I feel like we can do some really good work together, and we are so close on so many levels to making, you know, a step forward. That's my goal, is to utilize the strengths and make a bigger impact.
Phil, we have so many similarities in common. I know this interview isn't about me, but we like our how we got into nonprofit work, and my grandmother was a pianist. She had perfect pitch. Anyway, we have so many similarities. We're going to have to meet up at BDC or something.
Yes. And have a cocktail. Oh my gosh. Amazing. Perfect pitch. I'm so jealous to know that. I'm envious to, you know, somebody who can do that is really, you know, that's amazing. Wow.
I know, she was incredible. One of the things that I've been dying to ask you, so I was at Washington Days, and I'm sure, as you know, I used to work for NBDF. I was the executive director of the Colorado chapter.
Yes.
So, you know, have lots of little bird, you know, spy friends everywhere. And they were, you know, as one does. And they were just so, I don't even know the word. They were so enlightened and enthused and I think really inspired when speaking about you. You had multiple meetings. I know you met with some chapter leaders who, they are a tough crowd. And I know you spoke with family members and then also staff, your staff members. You have this wonderful staff that now has, you know, really is not in one place. They're all over the country. What were some of your impressions of some of these people that are so, you know, stalwarts in our community? I know you met a bunch, Washington Days in particular. What were your takeaways?
My biggest takeaway was really, it just hit me so strongly, was how strong the community is. This is a strong group of people. These are people who have gone beyond their own circumstances to help others. And that's why they were there. You know, it's one thing to, you know, take care of yourself, which is hard enough. For some people, they're thinking not about next year or, you know, broadly in the future. They're thinking about the next month, the next week, even the next hour, you know, because they're making decisions that are so hard to make. And then I came across these people who not only were managing their own lives and addressing some of the harsh realities of facing bleeding disorders head on, but also a willingness to advocate, to serve, to fight, to stretch and help others. I saw people, I was in conversations where people were sharing resources with each other, identifying ways that they could help each other. You know, and then thinking about strategy as to how they can help change the laws to help, you know, improve lives. And so to me, the community is resilient, the community is strong, and you know, they have my respect as a person who really is not sharing the same lived experience. I have such respect for what they're going through, what they're dealing with. And it's my hope that in the coming year, what I'm doing is I'm reaching out to lived experience experts, as I call them, as we call them, to get their story, to learn about what their experience is. And if I do that once a week and I meet a family and talk with them and really get to know them and really try to understand their situation, I think over the course of the next year, I'll have 52 understandings of a personalized lived experience, and I'll probably have more along the way. But if I can continue to do that, I'll start to get a taste of an understanding of what they're going through. And that helps me be a better leader. I feel like when you're serving a community, the paramount role for me is to make sure that I'm listening and understanding what people are wanting from us, what they need from us. And so if people were inspired by me, I can tell you I'm inspired by them.
Mm. Phil, your predecessor, Dr. Lynn Valentino, his tenure at NBDF was really defined by a vision of research and moving research initiatives along. He really bolstered that department within the organization. How are you and the board intending to kind of take his work forward? And how are you, you know, really, you seem very just naturally community-based, chapter-based, resource fundraising-based. How will those kind of visions align coming in the next, like, 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, that's a really important point. Amy, I think we're at a point now where Dr. Valentino, you know, Len has been very gracious in our transition. You know, he's made himself very available to me. We've met on a weekly basis at length to try to make sure that, you know, our team and our community understands that this is a positive change for the organization, that we're working together. And Len is leaving, you know, in the highest regard, and continues his service on our Pathway to Cures team. So he is still staying involved, but he's been very gracious. And, you know, I respect and understand the power of research, of new therapies that are being brought forward in a time frame that actually matters to families. You know, we think about research sometimes so far down the road that it doesn't seem relevant to us. You know, we have needs now. We have things that we have to address today. And when you think about research, oftentimes we think, well, that's not going to impact me. That's not my experience. I'm not going to be able to benefit from anything on the research side. But the truth is that technology is catching up to the science. And we're now able to bring new therapies forward in a time frame that actually matters to families. And so it is a different framework, a different mindset when you think about research today than maybe even 20 years ago. So I'm grateful that Len has led these initiatives. You know, the National Research Blueprint Summit just took place. It was a culmination of years of work, and you know, Mike Recht and our team, you know, is really committed. Maria Santea and others are committed to bringing this forward and taking some really positive next steps that can not only impact people in the future, but can impact families today in the near term. And then Terry Willey with our P2C, our Pathway to Cures initiative, we've been blessed with a bequest that someone left for us, and NBDF has invested millions. In addition to the bequest, we've invested millions of dollars into this idea that we can, because we're a rare disease community, we have to raise money ourselves too for research. We have to do our own work, and we rely on our partners in industry, and we're so grateful for their innovation and their partnership. And many of them were at Washington Day, so it wasn't just helping us with some resource development. It was actually participating and helping us on the ground, and we appreciate that every day. And they're in communities too, but I do feel like we have to do work ourselves. And so we've invested millions of dollars into this idea that we can bring therapies forward and benefit our community. But having said all of that, in the meantime, while we push forward and work toward a cure and curative therapies and new innovative ideas that can be helpful, we have people right now today who are urgently needing our help. There is an advocacy need. There is a need for education. There is a need for supportive care. There is a need for all of the public awareness initiatives that we have to bring forward. So while we push forward long-term, my priority moving forward is to continue to support the work that Len developed and the team developed. But utilizing the strength of our outstanding team at MBDF, we are going to continue to make supportive care, education, advocacy, public awareness, priorities, strategic priorities and imperatives for our community. And we're doing that not from the home office alone. We're doing this, if you can think about not only concentric circles, but really Venn diagram circles. You know, we're looking at overlap. We want to work with our chapters in every way that we can so that, you know, they can impact more lives and they can feel great about the work they do. Because I think we both know, Amy, having led in Colorado, you know, there aren't enough resources to do the work that you'd like to do and that you were doing. And I think that's true across the board, not only at MBDF, but really across the bleeding disorders community. So if we can really help support those local efforts, and the way I think about it, just so you're aware of like kind of what's in my head as far as how we want to do that, I think about awareness initiatives. You know, public awareness, initiatives, telling your story, getting the story out there, because I don't think the public really understands the consequence of bleeding disorders. I don't think they know that oftentimes you have joint bleeds and that can cause a whole series of challenges for somebody in addition to, you know, the bleeding disorder itself. The consequences of bleeding disorders are massive. The trauma of, you know, having injections and infusions and, you know, even now with sub-Q, it's still a needle and it's still, you know, like there's still challenges that people face. I don't think people really broadly know about this.
I don't either. There's a blood brother that called it lived-in trauma. If you're not, you know, infusing, there's a kind of this lived in trauma that like, am I going to bleed? Do I have enough medication? All that. Yeah. So yes.
Exactly. That's a great way of putting it. And so I think about public awareness and telling the story. I think about the services that we need to provide, you know, and I think about advancement. So that means fundraising so that local teams can have the resources they need. And then I think about participation and participating in whether it's clinical trials or participating in advocacy, participating in the mission. And the way I remember awareness, services, advancement, and participation is to think about the first letter in each of those words. And that's what keeps me going as I think about ASAP, because we have to have a sense of urgency about what we're doing. We really have to think about this as a marathon, but a world record marathon. Like those runners who are running as fast at mile 26 as we might run a 100-meter dash, you know, they're running so fast for 26 miles. That's how we have to do it. We have to be so fit that we can take this on and run fast, but also go together. We can't just do it alone. We have to do this together. And so I hope that thinking about ASAP and awareness, services, advancement, and participation will be the theme that we bring forward in our work together.
Phil, I thank you for your time today. This has been wonderful. I hope to have you back on the podcast at the end of the year. We like to kind of, you know, ask our CEOs to come back at the end of the year and be like, so how was it? You know, how was it? And, you know, kind of look ahead. So I'll invite you to come back in December. But thank you so much for this introduction. Those of you listeners who have not registered yet for the Bleeding Disorder Conference that will be in Atlanta in September, it's a great time to maybe go and register so we can, you know, get the feeling of this new administration and our organization. But I just thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. And I'll just say one last thing for people who are, you know, dealing with the consequences of bleeding disorders. When you are first diagnosed and you don't know what to do, we want you to feel that we're with you. And if you are dealing with the day-to-day challenges, we want you to know that we're with you. And if you are strong enough at that point and you've decided, you know what, I'm going to stand up and advocate and do something, we're with you there too. And we want you to know that wherever you are in your journey, that MBDF is with you. We're with you every step of the way, and we need you to be part of this community. You're a valuable part of this community. And Amy, you know, what you and Patrick are doing and have done for years is greatly appreciated. It's an honor to spend time with you.
Well, it's an honor to spend time with you as well and to partner with you and your organization. We have felt like we are very much, hopefully, an amplification of the work that y'all do. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
Y'all, Phil, nonprofit nerd. Could get really nerdy about it. Super nerdy about it. Love that dude. Hope y'all, can't wait to hear your reactions, actually. This is a big deal. We've had two new CEOs on the show here in like less than a month or less than 2 months. And I guess actually, as I look back on it, that's happened before as I think about it in our community and our sweet little community. But anyway, big transition time. Hope you guys enjoyed it. All the things. Let's move on to our gene therapy segment and the story of the very first commercially dosed hemophilia B gene therapy patient. I should mention, we've had multiple people actually, maybe not on the show, but that have spoken at several of our live conferences over the last couple of years that have been dosed with gene therapy, both for hemophilia A and hemophilia B. But I will say that this story in particular, and I just want to like push the clarity on, this is the first patient that decided to do it commercially. So they, after it was approved by the FDA, they had to get it approved by their insurance. They had to do all of the things, all the decision-making. And it's, I think it's a cool story. It happened in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which I also think is baller. Green Bay, Wisconsin. Cheeseheads. And I just think it's a cool story. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more of the story. Again, this segment is brought to you by CSL Behring, a global biotherapeutics leader focused on serving the rare disease community by providing innovative therapies. They now have the first of its kind treatment for hemophilia B. To learn more about this treatment option, visit beyondhemeb.com and download the B Support app from the App Store or Google Play to stay up to date on relevant information and to manage your treatment journey. Now on to our new gene therapy segment.
In this conversation, I would love to learn more about gene therapy for hemophilia B and what that journey has been for you. So could you just start by saying where is hemophilia B in your family, or is this something you struggle with? What's your relationship to it?
I have two different stories, essentially. You know, I'm the CEO of the organization that, you know, administered the first gene therapy commercially, but I'm also the father of a child with, he's not a child anymore, but a young adult with hemophilia B.
How long ago did he receive this treatment, and is it still really effective for him today?
Yeah, so he received it last June. So we're coming up on a year since his infusion. His levels have been increasing steadily, and he is at 42% at current time. So okay. Very, very effective. And I mean, lasting at least a year so far, or almost a year.
Gene therapy didn't exist for very long before that, right? Like,
correct.
This is a fairly new thing. So were you timid about trying something different? What were some of your concerns? Like, what was leading up to making that decision? What were some of the things going through your mind?
So as far as that, I mean, you know, he is an adult and he can make his own decisions. I had my hesitations with new therapies. You know, the way he came at it was he wanted to be the first so that he could lead this for other individuals, which was very admirable. And I was very proud of him for it. But it was scary and nerve-wracking as a parent, just because, you know, there's such limited data out there in regards to what's going to happen. Where is he going to be in the next couple of years?
Right. Absolutely. So you say he was the first. He was the first to receive this gene therapy treatment?
Commercially, yes. There were studies that have been done with individuals that had received the gene therapy, but he was the first in the country to receive it commercially through a hemophilia treatment center.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that would be nerve-wracking. I think I would be nervous too. So you said this was primarily his decision. What conversations did you maybe have with him leading up to it?
The possibilities that came out of it were just living a life more quote-unquote normal than having to do prophylaxis every week. Something that, you know, he had anxiety over, and it was stressful for him to do his infusions.
What are maybe some other ways that you kind of saw things change for him before getting the therapy to after?
his overall demeanor as an individual and a young adult, that was transformational, just in his being of receiving this gene therapy. It changed his whole demeanor in life, and just it created a very positive outlook for him.
I love that you keep really reinforcing how this was very much his decision as an adult, because as we know, like, you know, changing from that transition of like being a child to a young adult is a big deal. So part of me feels like I should be asking him these questions instead of you relaying it as dad.
I was wondering how I was going to go with that, because, you know, he is the adult and he is able to make those decisions. But, you know, there's definitely a piece of raising a child with hemophilia and that attachment and that closeness that you develop throughout the years, from traumatic events to acute issues and just everything you go through. Through a hemophilia treatment center and beyond, you just develop a really close relationship with your child, and very, you know, it's hard to let go. But the reality is, you know, he's a grown man, and you know, you have to support his decisions in life. He was the one that went through it, and you know, he wanted to take that step into the future.
We began this conversation talking about like how your son was really kind of leading the charge and saying, I want to do this, and you were a little bit more hesitant. So what is it at the point right now that if you are making this decision, you'd feel more comfortable with it? Or do you feel like there's still more work to be done before kind of that like big risk period is kind of passed? Does that make sense?
So I think knowing what I know today and seeing the success and the results of gene therapy and the administration of, and seeing that it's really not as big of a deal to receive the infusion as, you know, we all were very concerned about in the beginning, I would make the decision to allow him to do it if it were an option.
Once again, this segment has been brought to you by CSL Behring, which now has the first of its kind hemophilia B treatment. Visit beyondhemeb.com or download the B Support app wherever you get your apps for more information. Thank you to Phil Catone for joining us today, and thank you for Jameson and Mason Buxton for sharing your story on the gene therapy segment. It was fantastic. And of course, thank you to all the folks at Bloodstream Media for contributing and helping with today's episode, which of course would not be possible without our presenting sponsor, Takeda. Visit bleedingdisorders.com to learn more, as well as CSL Behring for their support of the gene therapy segment. We're going to be back on April 26th. It's going to be awesome. The I'm Fine segment is back, and we're going to have a conversation between Patrick and Luke Pembroke, which I think will be baller. So please, please set your calendar, set your alarms, all the things for that one. And that, y'all, is all for this episode. Be sure to subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast, you know, so wherever you listen, you'll have the next episode just delivered to you the moment it goes live, which is a very cool thing that technology allows us to do. And as always, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com is the email to use if you want to inquire about getting on our stuff. So if you want to be in a movie, if you want to be on a podcast, if you want to share your story, or maybe if you just want to rant and rave, please let us know about it. mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. That is the way you can get a hold of us, and also on social media. You can find Patrick on social media. You can find me on social media. And you can find Bloodstream Media on social media. I am your host, Amy Board. And from all of us, including Patrick, thank you so much for being with me today. And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, y'all.